A Time Watch special.
On a December night in 1942, a lone German aircraft approached the coast of England.
Inside, an enemy spy waited for the signal to jump. He carried a secret wireless, a gun, 12 detonators, and a suicide pill. His mission on behalf of Nazi Germany had been authorized at the highest levels of the Third Reich.
A parachute harness is secured.
His code name was Agent Fritz. But Fritz was not German. He was British.
He leaps out of the plane, and black and white footage shows a parachute opening, then drifting down towards the earth. Ben McIntyre, author, Agent Zigzag.
His real name was Eddie Chapman, and he landed in a field here in a remote corner of East Anglia. He was a crook, a womanizer, a con man, and a sort of hero. He was, perhaps, the most extraordinary spy in British history.
Within hours of landing, he would defect to the British and become a double agent. Agent Zigzag.
A face projected on a wall.
Eddie had to do something like that. He just didn't want to sit quiet. It was an excitement and nobody else had done it and he would.
A top secret file.
He was an extremely clever seducer. He seduced the Germans and he also seduced lots of women as well. So he's really quite a remarkable chap.
A yacht, then an old photograph of a young woman.
It was probably the love of her life. She met the man she considered her dream prince, I guess. If the Germans had found out about the story, then both probably would have been dead.
An iron cross.
He must have been an amazing person. I don't think there is anyone like him, no.
Double Agent. The Eddie Chapman story. A match lights a fuse leading to a safe door.
Of all London's pre-war gangsters, Eddie Chapman was in a league of his own. He never used violence and he never carried a gun, but he loved blowing things up. Especially safes.
Ben peels a bag with cash.
His speciality was robbing Odeon cinemas.
You know the big one in Swiss Cottage? I did that one. I did them alone. I looked around and I found a bag. I knew that the cleaners came on at 6 a.m. So I thought, Christ, I've got to get out before they come in.
Chapman hit the Swiss Cottage Odeon in London in September 1938, having spent the night hiding in the gents.
He had just minutes to get out and get to safety.
Recreating Chapman's getaway, Ben runs from the cinema and heads down to the nearest underground station.
This was the life Chapman loved, fast, furious and dangerous.
He was already wanted for safe-breaking, embezzlement and burglary.
So far, he hadn't been caught.
Ben hops on a train, clutching his bag of cash. Eddie Chapman, interviewed in 1993.
That time, all the old dears are going for office cleaning. It was full of them. And I had this bag on my knees. And I saw them all looking at it. What the hell are they looking at? And I turned the bag round, and in white letters, that big, it had Odeon Cinema Limited. It was the longest journey I ever did.
The elderly Chapman's a passenger in a white convertible cruising along a sunny mountain road.
In the great tradition of retired British crooks, Eddie Chapman lived out his last years in Spanish-speaking sunny climes. Even as an old man, he never lost his taste for fast cars, fast women and fast living. Before he died in 1997, he was interviewed by the BBC in the Canary Islands about his life as a double agent. But the Official Secrets Act prevented it from being broadcast. MI5 has since declassified the Zigzag files, allowing Chapman to tell his story for the first time.
I was actually spawned in the slums of the northeast coast. And my father drank quite heavily, and I decided I was going to get out of it completely. I'd reached my 17th birthday and applied to join the Guards.
Chapman didn't last long.
He quickly deserted and headed for the bright lights of Soho, home to London's criminal underworld.
A vintage car.
By the age of 25, Chapman was one of the most wanted men in the country.
A safe is blown open.
His forte was blowing safes.
There's the thrill of the excitement of it. Are you going to strike a bonanza or strike nothing? I mean, the one thing we have is money. Whenever we ran out, we used to go out and blow another one.
There were girls, fast cars, and as much champagne as a man could drink.
Bobby McHugh.
Eddie was a very attractive-looking man, you know, 6'1" or 2", and handsome, always well-dressed. And women used to throw themselves at Eddie. He had done something extra that women liked. Wine, women and song. He certainly liked them all.
Golf clubs.
By the spring of 1939, Chapman was wanted for more than 40 counts of burglary. London was getting a little hot.
So, throwing a golf bag stuffed with gelignite into his car, Chapman headed north. His target was the Edinburgh Co-op. But things didn't go to plan.
Squad cars came in from everywhere. Bang. I opened the car door, jumped out and ran. I had a bloody great overcoat on, and I tripped, and the whole lot pounced, and we were done.
Despite facing 40 counts of burglary, Chapman managed to get bail, which he promptly jumped. Pausing only to pick up his latest girlfriend, Betty Farmer, he caught a plane to the safety of Jersey in the Channel Islands.
A pianist wearing a tuxedo.
The next stop would be France and a boat to South America.
A hotel restaurant.
Comfortably settled at the Hotel de la Plage, Chapman and Betty sat down to a leisurely Sunday lunch.
The couple were tucking into dessert when Chapman looked up to see two burly policemen approaching the table. He rose from his sherry trifle, kissed Betty one last time, and jumped through the window, which was closed.
Ben crashes through the window.
He pounded off down the beach with the police in hot pursuit.
Ben scampers across the sand, leaving a trail of footprints.
But his luck finally ran out.
A cell door.
The judge showed no mercy. Chapman was sentenced to 2 years. After that, he faced another 20 years back on the mainland.
I was in the punishment wing alone. Sometimes I only got the bread and water, and this went on for weeks. My weight shot down from about 12 stone to about 9.
But outside the prison walls, Europe was falling apart.
Chapman was still serving his sentence when the world went to war.
Heavy artillery, infantry, and a German soldier standing guard outside a Royal Air Force headquarters.
In June 1940, the Germans invaded the Channel Islands, the only part of Britain to find itself under Nazi occupation.
One of the warders said to me, "The Germans have invaded." Christ, you know, I didn't even know there was a war on.
Ben standing in a cell.
To an opportunist like Chapman, the invasion offered an opening.
He wrote a letter to the German commandant in Jersey and made him an offer.
I didn't fancy doing 20 years. That was really me, basically. I thought, I've got to do something. So, without any set scheme, I volunteered to work for the Germans. I did this because I had this crazy idea I could pull this off.
Months passed. Chapman was moved from one prison to another and from Jersey to mainland France. And still, there was no response to his offer. Then he was suddenly taken from his cell and found himself face to face with two German officers.
They said, we've come to see you about your application to join us. And I stank like a fucking polecat.
Marching Germans.
They had their interview, answered all their questions and explained why I wanted to join them, that if the British ever invaded, I'd be doing 20 years and I'd much prefer to work for them. So that was my freedom from prison.
A speeding train.
Within hours of his interview, Chapman found himself on a train, sitting in a first-class compartment.
But what was he thinking? Had he really thrown his lot in with the Germans? Or did he always intend to double-cross them, as he later claimed? Or was this simply a way to get out of jail and perhaps make some cash on the side?
A white brick building.
His destination was a charming French manor house near Nantes in western France. This was to be his home for the next 3 months.
Chapman was met at the door by a distinguished figure wearing a pinstriped suit, who welcomed him warmly in perfect English. He looked like a prosperous city banker.
In fact, Stefan von Gröning was a decorated First World War veteran who now ran the most important spy school in Nazi-occupied Europe. He had personally selected Chapman for training as a German agent because Chapman was exactly what the Germans now needed.
London buses.
Up until this time, German intelligence operations in Britain had been a spectacular failure. Every one of their spies had been caught. The Germans had to find a spy, any spy, who could actually do some spying.
Piccadilly Circus.
Chapman was the perfect choice. He was English and therefore invisible. He had good reason to loathe the British authorities. And he was rather good at blowing things up.
Von Gröning said, you're going through a course now of espionage, code work and sabotage.
But before his training began, Chapman needed a code name.
Stefan von Gröning knew that the British routinely referred to all Germans as Fritz. And so Eddie Chapman duly became Agent Fritz.
Ben unfolds a deck chair.
For the next 3 months, Fritz's life followed a set routine.
4 hours of Morse code practice in the morning, followed by an excellent lunch and an afternoon siesta.
He sits back.
Later in the day, there were lessons in sabotage and the opportunity to practice his speciality.
The deck chair explodes.
I was taught about seven different formulas. If you've done it wrong, you blew your fucking self to pieces.
A plane.
There was also parachute instruction, the best way to get an agent into England.
On Chapman's second jump, his parachute failed to open properly. He landed on the airport tarmac face first, smashing his teeth. The Germans generously replaced them at a cost of 9,500 francs. He now had some rather natty gold teeth, courtesy of the Third Reich.
The French Manor House.
Chapman's instructors did everything possible to make life comfortable for their new secret agent.
Chapman purchased a pet pig, which he called Bobby, in honour of the Metropolitan Police.
He took Bobby on long walks through the French countryside and taught him to perform tricks, like a dog.
Ben walks a pig through a wood.
Could life possibly be better?
A large antenna, then a dial.
Chapman's instructors were not the only ones monitoring his progress. From deep in the Buckinghamshire countryside, others were following his every move. For months, the secret codebreakers at Bletchley Park had been eavesdropping on Agent Fritz's practice transmissions. They knew this German spy was being trained at Nantes. They knew how many teeth he'd knocked out and how much they'd cost to replace. And they knew he spoke English.
A lot of the messages would be from his handler back to Berlin. And we had what were called Y stations all over the UK at strategic points where they could pick up these messages clearly. They would have ended up here in one of the huts and it would have been compiled, recorded, so we knew exactly what was going on. And we would have been watching very closely.
Some of Fritz's transmissions were quite baffling. Your friend, Bobby the Pig, grows fatter every day. He's gorging like a king, roars like a lion, and shits like an elephant. Fritz. But who was this mysterious Bobby the Pig? And when would Fritz arrive?
Well, von Gruning took me out and gave me dinner. He said, now, you're probably wondering what this is all about. Are you willing to go to England to attack a target for us in England? So I said, yeah, for money. How much?
The money was 150,000 Reichsmarks, set down in a formal contract. But there was an additional clause.
In the event of this agent betraying the German Reich, he will be summarily executed. He said, you could fully understand the purport of it. So I said, yes, I signed it.
Chapman's mission was to blow up a major aircraft factory at Hatfield, just north of London. Here, Britain's most advanced bomber was being built.
A twin-engine aircraft.
The famous de Havilland Mosquito.
The very thought of the plane sent Goering, chief of the Luftwaffe, into a towering rage. It makes me furious when I see the Mosquito, he said. There is nothing the British do not have. They have the geniuses and we get the nincompoops. After the war, I'm going to get a British radio set. That way, at least I'll have something that works.
Mosquitoes in flight.
This is a thing of beauty in the skies of Britain. Above Germany, a sight to dread. No doubt Goering and Goebbels have bad dreams about it every time they're due to broadcast.
As several of the aircraft swoop over a city, black smoke rises into the air. The moon hanging in the night sky.
On the night of December the 16th, 1942, Chapman was ready to go. Everything he would need was packed into a British canvas rucksack. Wireless, detonators, fake identity cards, and £990 in used notes. Nothing was left to chance.
Except for one small but rather crucial detail. In an act of stupendous incompetence, the wads of money were held together with bands labelled Reichsbank Berlin.
After an excellent dinner in Paris, Chapman boarded the plane for England.
A propeller.
His hands were shaking so much, he could hardly strap himself in.
Wolfgang Ischinger.
They were flying relatively low.
which of course made the mission more dangerous because they could have easily been shot down. I think my father said, no way this guy is going to survive this. It was really mission impossible.
Somewhere over East Anglia, at 2:15 in the morning, Chapman jumped.
I was about 7 or 8 minutes coming down. And at night time, you think you're fucking going up. You know, all you can see is cloud. I floated over a house and then landed a few hundred yards away. And I did everything. I buried my parachute. And I did everything right.
But from that moment on, Chapman broke all the rules.
Ben crosses a stubble field.
His orders were to wait until dawn, then make his way to Norwich, catch a train to London, and begin his mission.
Instead, he went to the nearest house and telephoned the police.
Chapman, in 1993.
When I got to the police station, I was trying to keep my identity secret. Who are you? What? I said, I'm not answering you. I want to talk with British intelligence. I told him that I was here on a mission. I told him what the mission was about. He said, well, save that because they're waiting to interrogate you.
Within hours, Chapman was on his way to London. For months, British intelligence had been planning to catch Agent Fritz. But what nobody expected was that Fritz would turn up on their doorstep.
I thought I was being taken someplace comfortable to sleep, and I woke up in a cell. Fucking nice, I'm back in the nick.
Chapman was locked up in Camp 020, a prison for captured enemy agents. Here, he was immediately photographed. A face drained by stress and exhaustion stares out of the pictures. But there is something else in Chapman's expression, the hint of a smile.
An interrogation room.
For the next 48 hours, Chapman was interrogated. Facing him across the table was a man who wore a glinting monocle and had a fearsome reputation for breaking his victims.
This was Colonel Robin Tin-Eye Stevens, and it was his job to find out whether Chapman was telling the truth.
Eddie Chapman was interrogated, not at Bletchley Park. This would have had nothing to do with Bletchley Park. But, of course, the interrogators are looking for information to corroborate what is being said.
A transcript.
Chapman told Tin-Eye everything. A complete picture of the workings of a Nazi spy school. But he also made an offer to spy for Britain against Germany as a double agent. The pressure was now on Tin-Eye to decide if Chapman could be trusted.
What he didn't know was that we were able to corroborate much of what he said, which enabled the people who were doing the interrogations to feel more and more comfortable that actually he was an honest player in terms of being an agent.
After 3 days, Tin-Eye decided to take the gamble.
Chapman already had a contract with the Germans. Now he cut a deal with the British.
What conditions did you place on your working for MI5?
That all monies I earned with the Germans, I kept. I was granted a pardon for all my past peccadilloes. And they agreed to both.
A young man with slicked back hair.
A young MI5 officer was assigned to handle his case.
A radio.
A former BBC sound engineer, Ronnie Reed, was an expert in Morse code.
My father was needed because, as with all these double agents, when they're transmitting back to Germany, you've got to make sure that they send back the message that we want them to say, and we've got to make sure that they don't send a message that says, don't believe a word I'm saying, I've just been caught.
The next morning, Chapman tapped out his first message to his German spy masters.
Have arrived. Am well with friends.
I just laid the antenna around, plugged in. I gave two calls and I got the answer immediately.
Within hours, Bletchley picked up a German signal. It indicated that the enemy believed Chapman's message was genuine.
This was definitely Fritz. The deception was up and running. Only one thing remained before Chapman could begin his new career as a double agent. A code name. MI5 came up with one that fitted him perfectly. Agent Zigzag. The name carried a hint of anxiety, because a man who could zig could also zag.
A busy high street.
But if Chapman thought his new job was going to be glamorous, he was in for a shock. The Germans had installed him in a comfortable manor house in Brittany. The British installed him in this quiet, anonymous street in the London suburb of Hendon. The last place anyone would think to look for a double agent.
A row of semi-detached houses.
But he would not be living alone. A man who'd spent a lifetime avoiding the police now found two of them sharing the house with him and watching his every move. They also took the only photographs that exist of Chapman enjoying life as a double agent in Hendon.
They set up a radio transmitter in a top room, and from that point, Eddie could broadcast to Germany with my father supervising him. To start with, transmission was quite difficult. The Germans didn't seem to hear him. And then Eddie got the poker from the fire and heated it up and tried to re-solder it, which wasn't very effective. So my father took his transmitter back home, did it with a proper soldering iron, and after that it worked fine and the Germans heard every word.
The only other obstacle to Chapman's transmissions was Mrs. West, the housekeeper, whose vacuum cleaning had to be interrupted every time a message needed to be sent to Nazi Germany.
A candid photo of Chapman.
Chapman had now been in Britain for a month, but had not yet carried out his mission to blow up the de Havilland factory.
It was time for a most ingenious deception.
Nicholas Reed, historian and son of Ronnie Reed.
If they were going to convince the Germans that Chapman had blown up the factory, he first of all had to see exactly what it looked like and indeed work out a way, a convincing way, of blowing up an important part of it.
We walked through the morning shift. We just went in and overalls like everybody else. Nobody challenged us. We just went straight through them. We went up, I opened the powerhouse door, nobody there. So I went inside, had a look around, came out. I said, well, this is obviously where I would have placed the explosive. I knew exactly what to tell the Germans, and it was from that my cover story was patched up.
To reinforce his cover story, Chapman drew up a secret map of the factory. With his handler, Ronnie Reed, he now planned how to fake its destruction.
And so we agreed with him that we would camouflage a large part of the de Havilland factory to make it look as if they had blown up the transformers there.
The transformers were the power centre of the factory. The key was to make them look from the air as if they had been destroyed. MI5 now set about building replicas out of papier-mâché. Two would be rolled over as if slammed sideways by a blast. A team of set designers from London's Old Vic Theatre were secretly enrolled to paint fake holes on the walls as if they'd been shattered by an explosion.
I mean, they did a wonderful job on the camouflage. It was as near as possible to what the Germans had instructed me.
To back up the deception, a fake news story would appear in the next day's papers.
They first approached The Times, the newspaper of record. The editor, Robert Barrington Ward, rejected the idea out of hand, pointing out that nothing untrue had ever been published in this newspaper and he wasn't about to start now. The Daily Express, on the other hand, was only too happy to oblige.
A dimly lit hangar.
At dusk on January the 29th, 1943, the old Vicks designers entered the factory one last time to put the final touches to their work. Meanwhile, ballistics experts carefully laid the charges for a set of spectacular pyrotechnics.
At midnight, the residents of Hatfield were woken by a massive explosion.
We were there when the flare came up. It looked as though a bomb had exploded there. Anybody looking at the photograph would think it had really been truly blitzed. It looked as though it had been bombed.
Chapman immediately sent a triumphant wireless message to his German spy masters, using the codename Walter for the Mosquito Factory. But would the Germans fall for it?
They sent over aircraft to photograph it, which we led through, and they saw the sabotage.
The next day, the Daily Express duly ran a story about a mysterious explosion north of London. That same evening, Bletchley Park intercepted a signal from Chapman's German spymaster. It was the message everybody had been waiting for.
The gamble had paid off.
Absolutely marvellous.
At the spy school in France, it was champagne all round.
At last, the Germans had a spy who could outwit the British. And the British, equally delighted, had a spy who could outwit the Germans. A spy who now volunteered to do what no other double agent had done, to go back into Nazi-occupied Europe.
Why do you think Eddie went back into occupied Europe?
Excitement.
A questionnaire.
MI5 now drew up a wish list of information they wanted Chapman to gather. Enemy codes, personnel, military units and battle plans.
Nobody ever thought that I was going to come back. They did give me the opportunity to withdraw if I wanted to. But I had the gut feeling I could do it. I don't think they expected me back.
A sea crossing.
On May the 15th, 1943, Chapman set sail for neutral Lisbon, the entry point into occupied Europe. But he did not travel under his own name. He was now Hugh Anson, a steward aboard the merchant ship, the City of Lancaster.
My job was to wait at table, look after the skipper and the first mate. The skipper was tipped off that I'd be jumping the ship, not to make too much fuss about it.
Once in Lisbon, Chapman headed directly to the German embassy.
I asked to see the ambassador. I said, well, I happen to be a member of the German army. I said, I've just finished a mission in England and that I was an agent.
He was welcomed by the Chief of Intelligence and immediately invited to carry out a fresh sabotage mission to blow up his own ship.
And I said, well, what about money? He said, well, how much do you want? I said, for that, £20,000. Oh, yes, he said, we'll pay that. So I said, good.
The Germans now presented Chapman with what looked like an ordinary lump of coal. In fact, it was a new kind of bomb, packed with high explosive. Chapman's task was to return to the port and slip the bomb into the City of Lancaster's coal bunker. When the ship set sail again, the coal would be shoveled into the furnace and explode, sending her to the bottom. All hell broke loose when Bletchley Park intercepted German messages revealing that Chapman was about to sink his own ship.
Agent Zigzag was supposed to be spying for Britain. Had he switched sides again?
Of course, we were horrified and we were a bit worried that Eddie might in fact have turned and was now carrying out the German instructions. So we had to send somebody to tell him not to do that.
Ronnie Reed flew to Lisbon armed with a revolver. His orders were to find out if Chapman was betraying them, and if he was, to stop him.
Opening a watertight door, Ben descends some steps, then heads below deck aboard a ship.
That evening, as Reed was racing to Lisbon, Chapman returned to the city of Lancaster.
With the coal bomb carefully concealed on his person, he made his way below decks, deep into the ship.
He strides along a passageway that has pipes running along the ceiling.
But he didn't go down to the coal bunker. Instead, he went straight to the captain.
Ben enters the captain's cabin.
I said, look, I want you to take charge of this. And I undid my trousers and took this fucking bomb out. I said, that is a bomb. Take it back to Liverpool and report to Liverpool. I said, if you don't do it, my life will be forfeit.
Everyone was delighted. The Germans believed Chapman had planted the bomb. The British were fully reassured of his loyalty. And Chapman was £20,000 richer.
Snow-capped mountains.
And German generosity didn't stop there. A grateful Third Reich now rewarded Chapman with a luxury holiday in Nazi-occupied Norway. Despite the minor detail that the city of Lancaster never blew up.
A train station.
At Oslo station, he was greeted by his German spymaster, Stefan von Gröning.
The two men embraced as old friends. As the man who discovered him, von Gröning needed Chapman to succeed, and Chapman needed von Gröning to believe in him. They were now in it together.
For the next 2 weeks, von Gröning proceeded to grill Chapman, very lightly.
Over brandy and cigars, the German spymaster came to the unsurprising conclusion that his protégé was utterly reliable and Germany's star spy.
Ben reclines in an armchair.
What happened next was one of the oddest scenes in the entire saga.
Von Gröning stood up and presented to Chapman a small black box, and he duly opened it and took out from it the German highest honour of merit, the Iron Cross, complete with its ribbon, and handed it over to Chapman and said that Hitler had awarded Chapman this cross for his services to the Reich.
Nicholas Reed reveals something wrapped in handkerchiefs.
So, tucked in here, a little black box, and inside it is the Iron Cross that von Gröning handed to Eddie.
There it is. How extraordinary.
So it's a medal awarded to Chapman for two operations carried out on behalf of the Third Reich that never actually took place.
Quite right, that's it.
The bombing of the de Havilland plant and the blowing up of the Lancaster, neither of which happened.
That's right, they were both complete deceptions by our side.
And that is the original cross that your father was given by Chapman at the end of the war?
When he stopped running him and when my father went to France, that's right, before they separated, Chapman handed it over to my father.
And do we know what Chapman's reaction was to being given an Iron Cross?
Oh, I think he was absolutely delighted. I mean, he was also probably rather chuffed that having hoodwinked them so successfully, he was now actually being given an award for hoodwinking them. It's quite remarkable what he succeeded. I mean, it's supposed to be almost MI5's finest hour. And he was the only Briton ever to receive the Iron Cross.
A public fountain.
The war brought misery to millions, but not to Chapman. In occupied Norway, he was living the life of Riley. While armies fought and people perished, Chapman partied.
German soldiers in a restaurant.
Chapman's life was a world away from that of ordinary Norwegians. Bankrolled by the Third Reich, he had everything he could possibly want.
There was a beautiful restaurant, purely for the Gestapo and their intelligence people and the higher-ups in the German army. The food was superb. You could get all kinds of English cigarettes, chocolate. You could buy stockings for your girlfriend. You only had to mention it. It was there.
A residential street.
In a bizarre parallel with the MI5 set-up in Hendon, the Germans installed Chapman here, in this safe house in a comfortable suburb of Oslo.
A photograph of a teenage boy.
Leif Meyer was a boy of 17 living next door. He's lived here ever since.
There were lots of parties and noise from in there. They arrived in private cars, which they had confiscated from Norwegians. They could get very loud, from the evening into the early hours.
Chapman liked to drink at the Ritz.
One evening, he spotted two young women at a table. Posing as a French journalist, he went over, bought them drinks, and made them laugh.
He sips red wine.
Chapman was in his element.
A young woman.
One of the women was an 18-year-old model called Dagmar. Chapman was smitten.
I met a lovely little Norwegian girl and I persuaded her to come up. And she was petrified, you know, she saw these Gestapo people in uniform and they were a bit tough looking.
Ingebjørg Mathiasen, friend of Dagmar Lahlum.
We sat by the window having dinner. Then Chapman came over and talked to us. He was tall, very tall and slim, a very expressive face and smiley. She thought it was great to meet such a handsome man.
Hans Olav Lahlum, Dagmar's great nephew.
They met at a restaurant in Oslo, and that's one of the mysterious parts of the story. It was a restaurant in which many Germans were entertained. And so on. So I think from the start, when she first met him, she obviously believed he was a German officer.
Collaborators were despised and shunned by the rest of the population, especially women. Chapman appeared to be German. Dagmar was therefore sleeping with the enemy.
Pointing out of his window, Leif says, yes, it was just down there by the gate. I saw her coming and told her. She should stay away from the Germans, because when the war is over, the Norwegians will cut off all her hair. Then she started crying. I thought she was what we would call a German tart.
What Chapman did not know was that Dagmar was linked to the Norwegian resistance. And what Dagmar didn't know was that Chapman was a British agent.
They were both on the same side, and neither of them knew it.
Aboard a yacht, Ben pulls a rope, hoisting the mainsail.
The relationship swiftly blossomed.
Chapman wanted to sail with his new love in Norway's famous fjords, and so he asked von Gröning for a yacht, and got one.
Ben cruises along, with one hand on the vessel's tiller.
The two lovers spent an idyllic summer, growing closer every day. But the truth remained hidden.
Instant love, I think. Romance. It's a meeting between two rather young human beings in a very dramatic context. For Dagmar, it was probably the love of her life.
She thought he was wonderful. That's the impression he made on her. That he was rich and could give her a better life. That was the feeling she got.
I'd usually meet Dagmar in the morning, and we'd sail to the other end of the fjord, bathe, and absolutely delightful. I mean, we had a great love match, and I had the intention at one period of going back and marrying her.
Aboard Ben's yacht.
One evening, after a glorious day's sailing, Chapman opened a bottle of cognac and took an enormous risk. He told Dagmar he was a British agent and asked her to help him spy on the Germans.
Dagmar was thrilled by the revelation and moved into the safe house with Chapman. Secretly, they began gathering material for MI5. And they were perfectly placed for doing so. Oslo was a centre of Nazi spy traffic, and much of it passed through Chapman's safe house. And so Chapman asked von Gröning for another favour.
They gave me a camera. You had to have permission to carry cameras.
They took photographs of themselves relaxing at home, but they also photographed the safe house itself, as well as the spies, informers and collaborators who came to visit.
Gradually, we built up a hell of a dossier. We had photographs of 20, 25 agents there.
If the Germans had found out about the story, then both probably would have been dead. So it was definitely a game in which you were risking your life.
Inside the safe house.
Soon, they had filled several rolls of film. Now, they needed somewhere to hide them.
Ben pulls the ladder down from the attic, then climbs it until his upper half is poking through the hatch.
Chapman discovered that by bending back this metal sheet, he could stash the rolls of film behind, where no one would think to look. A treasure trove of secrets for which the British might one day pay handsomely.
Ben's yacht.
But after almost a year in Norway, Chapman's holiday was coming to an end.
Naval bombardment.
By the spring of 1944, the Germans were losing the war. The Allies were punching through Italy and would soon invade occupied France. The Germans now needed the services of their super spy back in Britain.
Hitler was ready to launch a new and terrifying secret weapon. A weapon he was convinced would destroy London and batter Britain into submission. The V1 rocket.
The rocket launches.
Fired from sites across the Channel, these were weapons of awesome power. But their navigation systems were crude. The Germans had little idea if they were hitting or missing their targets.
The V1 takes to the air.
Chapman's mission was to go back to London and report where they were landing. That way, the Germans could adjust their aim and hit the most vital targets.
They gave me a chronometer and they said, the moment you hear an explosion in London, you note the time down and you find out where it's landed. And if possible, a description of the destruction. So I said, great, fine. And I was to be paid £100,000.
Another V1 takes off.
In March 1944, Chapman said farewell to von Gröning, the spymaster and friend he had comprehensively betrayed.
A restaurant.
His parting from Dagmar was more painful. They spent the evening together making plans for after the war. the nightclub they would run in Paris, the places they'd travel to, the children they would have. He would not see her again for half a century.
Ben gets up and walks away from the restaurant table. Now he strides up to a red phone box standing next to a field.
In June 1944, Chapman landed back in Britain.
Ben makes a call.
Once again, the first thing he did was telephone the police.
He explained to the duty officer that he was a British double agent who had just been dropped by parachute. The constable on the other end told him not to be silly and to go to bed.
Agent Zigzag was back.
The London skyline. The anti-aircraft guns firing at a V1 overhead.
By the time Chapman arrived, more than 600 V1 rockets had already slammed into London.
A distant explosion.
Casualties were rapidly mounting.
The injured are carried away.
The Germans were aiming for central London. Chapman's task was to fool them into thinking that they were overshooting the capital here. That way, they would reduce the range and the missiles would fall short. Instead of destroying St. Paul's Cathedral, they would land in the empty fields of Kent.
The street in Hendon.
Chapman began sending messages back to Germany, pinpointing where the rockets were falling. Every one was a lie.
They altered the places slightly. They altered the times. They gave me the reports they wanted sent back to Germany, and I sent them back.
The flying bombs began to come over, first in ones and twos, and then all day long.
Sometimes I sent two and three a day. Flying bomb landed Regent's Park, 12:30.
A rocket hits the ground.
There were 9,000 bombs dropped on London. But we succeeded, in the short time we were doing them, in shifting them over the top.
Ben stands in front of a V1.
Thousands of lives had been saved by Agent Zigzag's lies. It was the high point of Eddie Chapman's career as a double agent.
But it was all about to come crashing down. With the end of war in sight, the allure of old instincts proved too much. Chapman resumed his life of crime by fixing dog races.
Did Eddie teach you about dog doping?
Oh, yes, everything.
And what was the technique for dog doping?
Well, you dope five dogs in a race and go with the sixth.
MI5 was not impressed. One of his handlers observed, Zigzag himself is going to the dogs. His boss, Sir John Masterman, one of the most senior figures in British intelligence, took him to task.
He turned round to me one day and he said, "Stand to attention when you're talking." And I knew I was getting under his skin. And I said, "I'd like to remind you one thing only." I said, "I'm not in your army, I'm in the fucking German army."
They didn't like Eddie. He didn't go to Eton. He wasn't one of them, but he did a lot more than most of them did for his country.
On November the 2nd, 1944, 6 months before the end of the war, Chapman was fired.
But he didn't leave entirely empty-handed.
The Germans had given him a yacht, a medal and money. The British gave him something more valuable. They wiped his criminal slate clean.
Agent Zigzag never went straight, but he also never went back to prison.
He would spend the rest of his life mixing with gamblers, gangsters and con artists. He returned to his old haunts and resumed his old habits.
Scotland Yard today revealed that it has details...
And he became famous.
I'd rather live for Germany than die for England.
And if we wanted you to die... or Germany?
In 1966, his life was romanticised by Hollywood.
Eddie Chapman, you're under arrest.
Christopher Plummer plays Chapman in Triple Cross.
Chapman revelled in his celebrity. He was even, for a time, occasional crime writer for the Sunday Telegraph, whose readers he warned against the attentions of people like him. And he married, too. He'd last seen Betty as he leapt through the window in Jersey in 1939. At the end of the war, he saw her by chance in a London bar and fell in love.
But in Oslo, Chapman's lover, Dagmar, suffered a very different fate. Arrested after the war for consorting with a man everyone believed to be a German officer, she was sentenced to 6 months in prison. No one came forward to say that this German officer was in fact a British agent.
He told her when he left during the war that he would return after the war as soon as possible if he was alive. So I guess it's probably a good guess that for many years after the war, she believed he was dead. She never found any other great love. I believe she tried to leave it behind somehow, to go on with life. But I do not believe she ever succeeded.
Ingeborg Mathiasen.
She probably thought that she would travel to England and marry him. Yes, she probably thought she would do that. So this was a big disappointment.
Half a century after their parting, Chapman traced Dagmar's phone number and called her.
I said, "You don't remember me." I said, "You knew me as Fritz." "Oh, Fritz," he said, "I know your real name now. Your real name is Eddie." I said, "Yes, I'm Eddie Chapman." "Oh," and she couldn't talk for a few minutes. "How are you?" And we've written to each other letters. But I'd love to go and see her again.
Soon after this interview, they finally met again.
You can only imagine how it must have been to meet him again. And reportedly, he promised to visit Norway and tell the story about what happened, which was probably important for her because she had a rumor for many years after the war for being the mistress of a German. But then he died before he was able to visit Norway. And that was probably the final knockout in the life of Dagmar. And she died herself some 2 years later, and the last years were very hard.
Chapman reading a newspaper.
Eddie Chapman died in 1997 at the age of 83.
His camera, fake ID and fingerprints.
Chapman was a rascal and a romantic. He was selfish, seductive, and staggeringly brave. He had a most enjoyable war, but he also helped to win it. In the final victory, Britain owed an important debt to this most unlikely hero.
A common criminal sitting in Hendon, tapping out lies on a wireless.
Ben walks away from the Hendon semi.